From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
A lot of people are not even focused on the issues we talk about. If you say acronyms like RFRA or RLUIPA to them, they have no clue what you're talking about, or for that matter, without explanation, how truly important it is to guaranteeing their own faith and their own religious freedom.
Rabbi Jack Moline has been leading Interfaith Alliance since taking on the title of president in 2015. In the years leading up to that, Jack was deeply involved in the work of the Interfaith Alliance as an active board member and for 2 years, the chair of the board. Earlier this month, he announced his intention to retire in 2022, and Jack will be here to talk about his tenure at Interfaith Alliance.
Is there a law prohibiting free speech or blasphemy? Is there prohibitions against humanists or non-religious people from holding political office? Items like that.
This week, Humanist International released its annual Comprehensive Freedom of Thought Report 2021, full of important data about the legal and human rights situation for humanists, atheists, and the non-religious around the world. I'm looking forward to getting some highlights from American Humanist Association Policy and Social Justice Director Rachel Deitch.
I'm Ray Kirstein from the intersection of religion, government, and raw power. The U.S. Catholic bishops gathered in Baltimore this week with an expressed interest in unity. But the American hierarchy is as fragmented, it appears, as is the rest of our society right now. Where the church might be serving the critical task of bringing people together around shared values, L.A. Archbishop Gomez doubled down on his vision of a historically Christian, dogmatically defined American culture. Others were loudly preparing to push for withholding sacraments from Catholic politicians they don't feel they have enough control over, to hell with repeated entreaties from Pope Francis himself to avoid such rhetoric. A number of court cases are being tried simultaneously, and progressive faith leaders are making sure they are on hand to represent faith values that are often overlooked in public coverage. Hundreds of black pastors continue to stand vigil at the trial of Ahmaud Arbery's accused killers, despite the defense incredibly claiming that their presence was intimidating to jurors. Meanwhile, hundreds were arrested in the nation's capital at a protest led by the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign over voting rights and discrimination. And House Minority Leader McCarthy weighed in on this week's unprecedented violent imagery from House members Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, who were removed from their committee assignments by outraged colleagues by promising to reinstate the disgraced Republicans if the GOP regains the majority next fall. Maybe even better assignments, McCarthy clarified. Greene in particular has outraged many Americans with obnoxiously and consistently anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim rhetoric, which is apparently right in line with the leader's vision for his party and its future.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. This is an unusual interview in the sense that I'm here to interview Jack Moline about his announced retirement from the position I myself retired from in 2015, when he assumed the position of president at Interfaith Alliance. Well, I've enjoyed thousands of conversations with Jack over our decades of friendship and collaboration. A public conversation is something different. And yet, given the resources Interfaith Alliance has devoted to keeping this program on the air all of these years, it only makes sense to share some of our shared and unique experiences in this forum. And so, my friend, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. I sort of feel like we're driving along the highway, each of us in a car keeping pace with each other. Your listeners may or may not remember that I was on the search committee that hired you to become the executive director and then the president of Interfaith Alliance. And then you essentially recommended me for the position. And here we are, both of us, trying to find the exit ramp.
Well, now, look, I don't want to be unkind here, but I sometimes think that you all are getting soft, retiring already at your young age.
I'm only going to be 70 next year, so I know, you know, I got a few good years ahead of me. I just have to find a gig like you have.
Oh, my. Well, in all seriousness, now, what was the announcement made on November 1st about your plans?
Look, I was always hoping to be retired by now, but when the opportunity to sit in the leadership position at Interfaith Alliance presented itself, I took it for what I thought would be a short period of time, but I have enjoyed it so much, and we've made so much progress building on your successes that I just decided to wait a little bit. But now it's time to enjoy my grandchildren, celebrate my middle daughter who's getting married this spring, and do some of the things that I just haven't had time for because the demands of protecting faith and freedom have been substantial, as I don't have to tell you.
Yeah. Jack, why don't you recount your long affiliation with Interfaith Alliance for folks who may not know that history?
Yeah, not too many years after Interfaith Alliance was founded, I was approached by the leadership because they were looking for some younger leadership on the board. And you know, 25 years ago, I passed for younger leadership. I was very impressed with the kinds of people who were engaged. They were people I admired from my activism in other causes when I was younger still. And the ability to sit around a table with those folks was just so appealing to me on a question that has always been close to my heart. So I spent probably about 15 years on the board, including a stint as chair of the board. Then because of some of the successes I had there, I had the opportunity to represent my denomination, Conservative Judaism, in Washington. It was a volunteer position, but an official one. And in order to do that with integrity, I resigned from all of the positions I had of leadership in other advocacy organizations. So there was a brief period of time between my resignation from the board and your plea to me to allow you to do what you had intended to do for a while, where I was not involved with Interfaith Alliance, but I never lost interest, and your readers should know, listeners should know, I never stopped contributing.
Yes. And you also were always very loyal in asking other people to help us get some more money to do what we needed to do for the good of our nation.
Yeah, not only money, Welton. You know, you asked me many times, and I was almost always able to say yes because the cause was so righteous. To speak up with the voice of someone who carries the title rabbi on issues that might not have been quite so front and center in the Jewish community regarding religious freedom, particularly in defense of communities with which the official Jewish community may have had some disagreements from time to time. So not only was I grateful for that opportunity to have my voice amplified, but it really taught me a lot about the importance of not just being in this cause for your own interests, but for having the integrity to stand up for the principles that the Constitution and our society ought rightly endorse all the time.
Jack, I remember well, you were chair of the board in 2008 when you were invited to an interfaith audience with Pope Benedict. That led to the earliest state of belief interview with you that we could find, and I want to share a bit of that with our listeners right now. First of all, describe the setting in which you met with the Pope. Where were you? What did it look like?
The Pope was very generous in hosting an interreligious group at the Pope John Paul II Cultural Center, which is right next to Catholic University here in Washington, D.C. There were about 150 people there from various faith traditions, not including the various Christian traditions except as represented by the Catholic Church. This was really the Pope's outreach to other religious communities.
And what topics did you talk about?
The Pope made quite an important presentation as far as I'm concerned as a Jew and as I think the other faith tradition representatives meant. He was quite clear that religious diversity was one of the foundations of the human experience, and that was what was most important for all of us is that we talk together to find the truth, to get down to the bedrock truths. It was not quite as important what faith you practiced as it was that you be engaged in the search for truth together.
Now, I may not be remembering this exactly, but wasn't one of the official declarations into which he had input about the superiority of the way of Catholicism?
You would not have known it from his presentation.
Huh.
He was very clear that what Christians brought to the table was the message of Jesus and the power of Jesus as a personal Savior. But he was also very clear to affirm that truth comes from where it comes, that it does not come from a single faith community.
If you could have said something to him, anything you wanted to say, what would you have said?
Well, you know me well enough, Welton, to know that I'm torn between two things. It was just before the holiday of Passover. One of the ways we refer to our holidays in the Yiddish language is Yontif. So on the one hand, I would have wanted to say, good yuntif puntif. On the other hand, in my more serious role, and particularly if I'd been identified by name, I probably would have congratulated him on the message that he gave, affirming essentially faith and freedom. The talk that he gave to that interreligious group could have been a talk that I heard at the Interfaith Alliance.
That's Rabbi Jack Moline speaking on State of Belief Radio in 2008. There's more with Jack coming right up. And later, the 10th Annual International Freedom of Thought Report from Humanist International. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Jack, I made my unwitting contribution to the climate crisis by flying back and forth from Washington to Monroe, Louisiana, most weekends for years. Seems like a whole more years than it actually was. But you know what? That helped me stay grounded with America outside the Beltway. There were numerous times when I had spent all of a week talking about one thing that was real hot in the Beltway, and then I'd get off the plane in Monroe, and no one mentioned that topic, and no one really actually cared about that topic, but they did tell me right away what was bothering them, what was important to them, and it was important, and that helped me, I think, to know what was going on in Washington, what was going on in Monroe, and how all of that could come together. You never lost touch with the Alliance's constituency nationwide. How did you do that?
Well, I had to be far more intentional about it than you did, Welton, because as you said, you got on that plane in Monroe, Louisiana, and I applied for that job, but you had it, so I had to find a different way to do it. I'm still very intent on being in touch with friends and colleagues, many of whom are both, who live in different parts of the country, and talking to them about what their concerns are. As you said, a lot of people are not even focused on the issues we talk about. If you say acronyms like RFRA or RLUIPA to them, they have no clue what you're talking about, or for that matter, without explanation, how truly important it is to guaranteeing their own faith and their own religious freedom. So my intention is always to be in touch at least a couple of times a week with people who are not deeply involved in the work that we're doing. At the same time, it's important for me to be in touch with people with whom Interfaith Alliance is deeply allied, because even though we have a perspective on all these various things, it's not always the same perspective as the people with whom we're in coalition and partnership.
Yeah.
And if I don't hear what they're doing, then I only consider the perspective that our intensely wise but very small staff presents about any given issue.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel your decades of work as a congregational rabbi, as well as an activist all along, equipped you for the unique role of leading Interfaith Alliance?
You know, that's a very kind question, because it presumes that I was equipped to lead Interfaith Alliance. I found myself in that position and worked my way into it. But I'll say, well, one of the differences between your qualification for that leadership and whatever qualifications I had was that you were very familiar with the community with which we contended for many, many years. Mm-hmm. You emerged from that Southern Baptist tradition. You were a colleague, if not a friend, of many of the people who were the target of criticism, particularly in the early years. I'm a rabbi. I came from a Jewish community, which is, however large it is in any given area, is in the context of the United States, a tiny, tiny minority. We're less than 3% of the population of the United States, and concentrated in mostly urban areas on both coasts and a few major cities in the Midwest. So what I brought to the position was an understanding of what it meant to be in the religious minority and to have to advocate for the rights, the freedoms, the privileges that every minority in this country ought to be able to presume. Mm-hmm. But every minority in this country also knows they need to remind the majority of every now and then, because otherwise it's easy to overlook them. So building on what you were able to do in terms of establishing our credibility as, to use an image from Genesis, as a helpmate against the religious right who come largely from the Christian tradition, I was able to bring the smallest voice and try to amplify it on behalf of other small voices in the United States. That, I think, is what gave me my own unique take on the work that that you did so well.
But I have to tell you, Jack, that it may have been a small voice for you. For me, your voice was a large voice, because I wasn't knowing what you knew. I wasn't hearing what you were hearing. And it was terribly important. And it was you, and it was the kind of board that we had with great diversity, that we were hearing things from each other that each other had not heard. And so what you did in your voice was to make us be honest and to be knowing how to deal with other things that we hadn't dealt with. So don't put yourself down there, because that was very, very important.
Well, that's very kind. And Welton, you know, if I can return a compliment, you were always open to hearing dissent. I never knew you to make a decision that wasn't negotiable if there was a good argument for it. You'd dig your heels in appropriately if someone was just being obstinate. But when somebody had something to talk about, you always had the ability to listen and also to look down the road. I wonder if you remember the board meeting in which we first had the discussion about who we might find to be the voice, the popular voice of Interfaith Alliance, the way Walter Cronkite was during his retirement until he wasn't able to do it for us anymore. Yeah. I just remember you're leading that discussion and some of your staff, and you made a point of hiring younger staff to keep the organization vital and fresh. The staff suggested a guy named John Stewart. And I just remember the look on your face when most of the people on the board said, "Who's John Stewart?"
Yes, I do. But there were many times that they mentioned things that I didn't know who that was or what they were doing.
By the way, we didn't get John Stewart. No,
we didn't. I do remember that. I remember the letter that I got from him. Yes. Obviously, and thankfully, this is a conversation that will continue across future programs. But for right now, what would you consider the most important achievements by the Alliance team during these past 6 years?
I somehow had an idea that you might ask me that question.
Good.
I will say that there are three that I am very proud of, two of them entirely unexpected, and one of them the result of a tremendously fortunate hire that I made. The first, which anybody who works on any kind of a budget, household or institutional, might know, was our ability to put Interfaith Alliance and State of Belief on a sound financial footing. That was not an easy process and a little more difficult in these challenging days that we've been dealing with, but we've managed to do it, and it enables us to focus on our mission much more intensely than on our fundraising. And that's, I think, extraordinarily important. Yeah. Facing outward, the establishment of relationships with our partners, and our partners not only among the minority groups and not only among the advocacy groups, but among faith communities and communities of people who do not profess a faith, that kind of cooperation and collaboration that we've been able to promote during these past 7 years have been extraordinarily rich for me personally, for the organization, and for elevating our profile even beyond the place at the table that your administration established for us. And the accidental one, the one that I'm sort of astounded at myself, has to do with operating during this pandemic. When we abandoned our offices, we thought for a few weeks back in March of 2020, and I suddenly, I've always lived around the corner from the synagogue where I was the rabbi. I never thought I'd have a shorter commute than that. And now, you know, I have a commute that's about 30 seconds from my bedroom to my office, which is wonderful in terms of my commuting, but it is a little isolated. And we had to find a way to reach out to people. And we did that through two remarkable web series that we did, Stay Home, Stay Focused, which is still available, in which we did during the early days of the pandemic, 49 consecutive weekdays of interviews with people from all walks of religious and political life about how they were handling the isolation of the pandemic and how their faith and their interests were propelling them through that. You were the anchor on both ends of that series.
Thank you.
And then this series that we are just about to conclude at the end of 2021, The American Purpose, which has featured, and will feature by the time we're finished, 24 observers of the American scene from faith perspectives, from academic perspectives, from political perspectives, and from cultural perspectives on what the United States is, what it was, and what it ought to be. They've just been extraordinarily rich conversations. And our ability to reach out to people as a result of that is something we probably never would have considered if people were still out and running around and going to events rather than sitting down, as I am, in their office and turning on their computer.
Mm, goodness. I know the religious freedom landscape has changed enormously during your tenure. This is hard for people to believe, but it is true. When I began my tenure, it was difficult, if not almost impossible, to get the people who cover the news to do a story on religion and politics. We worked hard to try and do that. Now you know what's going on. And religious freedom back then was just everybody either goes to church or they don't go to church, or everybody, when they talk about religion, talks about church rather than all of the other religious people who are around us. And so that has changed, and with Yep. that change came changes in what religious freedom was understood to be. So what have been the most unexpected changes that you've met, and what did it take to address them as they emerged?
So let me turn the question around on you for a minute. There were obviously breakthrough moments for Interfaith Alliance in trying to promote this the importance of the media focusing on religious freedom. Do you remember a story that you said, we finally have broken through somewhere?
You know what it was, and at that time, and it was intentional, and it was intentional in talking with the staff. I said, look, I'm going to get on any program I can get on to try to get a place where we might go back and get to talk all that we want to talk about rather than what someone else wants to talk about. And the biggest one was for the news. I think it was I can't remember which news it was, but it was a day when the people with whom I had worked with in the Southern Baptist Convention made a stupid story about how women ought to bow down to men. And I got on the evening news for that. And it was it took about 30 seconds, maybe not that long, but with that very time, everything broke open, and we got to be able to talk about what we wanted to at the Interfaith Alliance.
And you sort of parlayed that into your ability to speak out on social issues that people generally did not associate with religious freedom.
That's right.
Your advocacy on behalf of the LGBTQ plus community really was the first among faith-based organizations. There were plenty of organizations willing to embrace the occasional gay or lesbian, but only one organization, that was Interfaith Alliance, under your guidance, was willing to step up early and say, this is a matter of religious freedom. The only objections to people being able to love whom they choose to love were religious objections, and therefore it was a violation of the Establishment Clause. Yeah. So you managed to do that. I've discovered that because of that, there are so many religious angles to what's being promoted, especially by the political right in this country. It's not just the religious right anymore. That if we don't get out there fast, we don't get out there at all. There are 100 people lined up, ready to either praise or condemn somebody thumping scripture in order to prove their point. That we really have to be, if anything, less intentional about curating our stories and more intentional about focusing on what's going on. I mean, this episode will air the week that Mike Flynn, the former advisor to President Trump, made a declaration in front of a cheering crowd that we not only need one nation under God, we need one religion under God. I mean, for goodness sakes, I imagine there's a line a mile long of people ready to comment on that, and unfortunately, some of them favorably.
Yeah, that is right. Yes, and that goes on to another trail, and we're out of time. It went quickly, but I look forward to us picking up here and having some more conversations like these. It's really powerful for me to understand what you've been through and what that whole Interfaith Alliance has been doing all of these years now. Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. This month, he announced his intention to retire from the position next year. We're going to talk about that more on the show. Jack, thank you for this conversation. Thank you also for always being a strong supporter of this radio program. We'll talk more in the weeks ahead on State of Belief Radio.
I'm saving a rocking chair for you, Elton.
There's more of our program coming right up. You'll hear about the Humanist International Freedom of Thought Report 2021. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Freedom of religion is a term that is more and more frequently used and misused. At the same time, there's a freedom that's even more basic for any person on this planet. Freedom of conscience, freedom of thought. And on this front, the organization Humanist International has been compiling an annual global Freedom of Thought report for the past 10 years. The 2021 edition was released this week, and I am happy that it brings American Humanist Association Policy and Social Justice Director Rachel Deitch to State of Belief Radio. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Please, let's start with you describing for us the objectives of this annual report, if you would.
So the objective of the report is simple. It's to track the treatment and rights of humanists and non-religious people in every single country around the globe.
And how many countries are included in the 2021 edition of the Freedom of Thought report?
That's a great question. So this year will be the first year that the report only updates a third of the countries. Humanist International, who are the publishers and authors of the report, felt that it was important to ensure that they can dive deeply into every single country. So this year, there'll be new updates for a third of the countries.
Hmm. Talk about, if you would, the ways freedom of thought is measured and ranked in this report.
Yeah, so there are more than 70 boundary conditions, which are statements that may or may not apply to every country in the report. And what they do is they fall into four categories: constitution and government, education and children's rights, family, community, society, religious courts and tribunals. That's all looped in as the third category, and freedom of expression and advocacy of humanist values. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And every country is basically measured against these boundary conditions, be it, is there a law prohibiting free speech or blasphemy? Is there prohibitions against humanists or non-religious people from holding political office? Items like that.
Are you able to pull out a top five and bottom five countries and talk about some of what earns them those positions?
That's a great question. When you think about top five countries, there's so many criteria that go into what we think of when we think of freedom of thought around the world, that to limit that to five countries, mm-hmm. I'm not sure we could really do that justice. What the report found was that there's 144 countries around the world that restrict the rights of humanists or which humanists are discriminated against. There's 39 countries with state religion. There's state legislation derived from religious laws in 35 countries. I could go on and on. And so I think to restrict it to just five would lose the scope in the picture of what the report really does.
As you look at this year's report, what were the biggest surprises for you in this year's findings?
Yeah. So I think the two most surprising things to me came out of two new boundary conditions that were added to the report this year. One was on the use of conscientious objection clauses that result in the denial of lawful services to women and LGBTI folks. And the second new boundary condition is that there's a dominant influence of religion in public life that undermines the right to equality and non-discrimination in 24 countries. And when you look at those together, I think what the report does a really good job of is understanding how religious freedom of religious minorities, including the non-religious, also intersect with the rights of women with sexual health and reproductive health rights, along with LGBTI people. I think, you know, those 24 countries, which you can find on the report's website, are all available to take a look at. I think the countries, of course, that still have death sentences for blasphemy, you know, we want to see that number going down, and unfortunately mm-hmm. we're not. And so I think more needs to be done in that area as well. And that's, you know, something that you hope we move the needle on, but is always dismaying to see that, unfortunately, those bad actors still have those egregious laws in place.
There's no question that freedom of thought is essential for the protection of freedom of religion. And yet, again and again, we see secular persons as well as followers of minority religions being marginalized and even persecuted. Why do you think societies, including our own, seem so blind to the rights of less popular belief systems?
That is a great question. I think when we talk about those concerns, what it comes down to, in my view, is fear of change, fear of difference, fear of someone saying the way you see the world isn't the way I see the world. When we're talking about religion and belief, we're talking about core values and foundational understandings of the way the world works. And so on an interpersonal level, myself as a humanist and as an atheist, my existence, my statement that I don't believe that there's a God, it to some people is blasphemy, is a threat to the way they see the world and the way they live their lives. And when you take then individuals and you create systems and you create infrastructure and you create systems, you know, that translates into governance, that translates into laws, it translates into weaponizing one's belief, unfortunately, sometimes. And I think that's where you get, you know, the restrictive laws that this report tracks.
Rachel, I'm curious as to what we need to know about the partnership on this report and beyond between American Humanists and Humanist International.
Yeah, of course. So the American Humanist Association, my organization, is a member organization of Humanist International, whereas the American Humanist Association represents the interests of humanists and non-believers in the United States. Humanist International does that on a global level. And so while Humanist International is the author and the publisher of this report, the American Humanist Association was honored to be asked to host this year's global launch event in the United States. This year's event is virtual, so it's not, you know, in Washington, D.C. per se, but we were very honored to take on that role.
Mm-hmm. Across the 10 years that this has been going on, what are some of the trends that have emerged that you know that you're going to deal with?
I think we're seeing greater pressures. And, you know, going back to that boundary conditions of these are two new boundary conditions, and the items they focus on aren't particularly new, but we're capturing them in new ways. So when we think of conscientious objection, and it's something we're seeing in the United States, especially of people saying, I'm not going to treat you as a medical practitioner, for example, I'm not going to treat your medical needs because of my religious beliefs. I think that's a really scary trend that we see. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the influence of religion in public life. I think what's really important when we're talking about the rights of non-believers is that it's a concealable identity. Well, you don't look at me and know that I'm a humanist. Mm-hmm. Why would you? But in a lot of places around the world, the ability to conceal that identity in some ways is a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of being respected and or ostracized by your neighbors and your family. And so what we're seeing, what this report tracks in some ways is practices, is stigma, which is really hard to capture. But when we're looking at the metrics of who feels able or protected to share their thoughts and their values out loud, I think we're seeing that tracking in some scary directions.
Hmm. What are the very real costs to citizens when freedom of thought is curtailed? And do people tend to take that seriously enough, do you think?
I think in the United States, we certainly take it for granted. I think in my international work, the very, very real costs of this are people's lives at stake. It's people like Mubarak Bala, who's been incarcerated since April 2020. He is the president of the Nigerian Humanist Association, and he was arrested and very recently charged with insulting religion. And so he is in custody still without access to basic human rights because of his beliefs, because of his identity. That is a very real human cost. His safety and life is at risk. His family's safety is at risk. Other humanists in Nigeria, of course, their rights are restricted. And then you also have, you know, I don't want to just limit the conversation to humanists. You have Ahmadi Muslims being killed in Pakistan for their beliefs. Mm-hmm. That is a very real face on the limitations that folks have around the world when it comes to their religious rights.
Mm. Pluralism and diversity have been on the rise in many parts of the world. Has that helped increase freedom of thought in those places, or has there sometimes actually been a backlash leading to greater dominance by a threatened majority?
You know, I don't have evidence to speak to the latter there, mm-hmm. but when we're talking about positive developments, you know, Ireland and Canada more recently repealed their blasphemy laws. And that is pressure. It's pluralism. It's greater respect for diversity of thought. And that matters when we're talking about moving the needle in these countries where those laws are still applied. We're able to point to positive changes. We're able to point to the value of religious diversity, diversity of thought, diversity of expression. And that, I think, matters in a really positive way. So I would always push for more pluralism, more diversity of thought. The more voices we bring to a conversation, I think the stronger that conversation will be.
In all of these areas, what are you seeing about what's happening to women in this?
Yeah, so the same way that LGBTQ people and other religious minorities are discriminated against or persecuted through the justification required through religious beliefs, the same applies to women. You see women accused of blasphemy laws because they're willing to stand up and, let's say, start their own business. You see women's rights restricted through religious means. The access to abortion comes to mind throughout the world, as well as other sexual reproductive health medical needs. And you see religious limitations from all sides. You see health restrictions, you see employment restrictions, you see marriage restrictions and freedom of education restrictions. Gulay Ishmael is one of the guest speakers on our event for the launch. She's a Pashtun women's rights activist, and she has experienced firsthand the connection between women's rights to civic engagement, women's rights to education, as well as tied to blasphemy laws and blasphemy accusations and her right to be a humanist and an atheist. And in her mind, all of those combined into one kind of field of activism.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what have I not asked you about this report? Because you know it better than I do. And I want to get what is really important to our listeners, and you will know that if I haven't asked it. So tell us what else we need to know from you.
I think what you need to know from me is that evidence is best understood firsthand, so I'd encourage everyone to go look at the report. It's at humanist.international is how you can access it for yourself. It's an iterative report. It is virtual. It is interactive. And so if you're interested in a particular country or a particular boundary condition or way of rating the report, go find that out for yourselves. It's exhaustive. You could spend days looking at this report, and I wouldn't attempt to give it to you in a 3-piece soundbite. So please take a look at the report for yourselves.
I'm curious if once you pick up this year's publication and you look at it, do you say in relation to what we've known over the 9 years before, we're not making any progress, or we are making progress and I'm optimistic?
I think we're making progress just by virtue of what the report is and what it means. When you think about policy and how we kind of create the world we need to have for all people to experience their inherent human dignity, knowing where the problems are is the first step. Knowing what countries are doing something well is the first step. And so the report, just how broad it is in scope and yet how detailed it is, that to me is a piece of power. That is a piece of being able to walk into a congressman's office and say, this matters. Here's the data you need to really understand so that the policy that you create is helpful to these people, is helpful to these communities. And so what I've seen in my short time working with the American Humanist Association is that the data matters and you have to follow it and you have to be able to collect good data. And that's hard to do when you're talking about stigmatized minority groups. It's really hard to collect that information. And I think we've gotten better at it over the years. I think I've seen other organizations, do it better as well. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has started paying more attention to the rights of humanists. The State Department's paying attention to how our rights are infringed globally. And I think the more reporting we can do, the better. And so I'm going to say that things are looking up because we're seeing more data, and that in itself is helpful.
Well, before we go, how can our listeners follow and support the work of the American Humanist Association and Humanist International?
Love that question. If you're in the United States, you should absolutely become a member of the American Humanist Association. You can visit our website at AmericanHumanist.org. Or if you just want to stay in the loop with what we're doing, you can check us out on Twitter, American Humanist, without the A in can. So American Humanist is our Twitter handle, and please follow us on Twitter. With Humanist International, if you're joining or listening from outside the U.S., definitely take a look at their website and see if you can find a humanist group in your area.
Hmm. Rachel Deitch is Policy and Social Justice Director at the American Humanist Association, which partnered with Humanist International on the release of the 2021 Freedom of Thought Report. We'll link to that important report from stateofbelief.com. Rachel, I really want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, for enlightening us. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.